You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, Spine number 85, Kill Bill, The Whole Buddy Affair. Featuring Uma Thurman, Feet, Uma Thurman's Feet, Samurai Swords, Machine Gun Massacres, Poisonous Snakes, David Carradine, David Carradine's Feet, Anime, Kung Fu, Sonny Chiba, Sonny Chiba's Feet, Live Burials, Dead Kids, Yakuza Crime Lords, and Buck, who likes to fuck. Martin.
Yes.
Silly Caucasian girl likes to play with samurai swords. Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining us as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, is 4.5 hours of Quentin Tarantino too much?
No.
Yeah, I would agree with you. But also agreeing with us is our special guest for this episode, James Shapiro. James, stop reading the fucking book.
Hi.
He's reading a Kill Bill guide and screenplay.
Since he's so jazzed for this episode, we're just going to come right out and put his feet to the fire a little bit. Is this Quentin Tarantino's best movie, or is this your favorite Quentin Tarantino movie?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of my favorite movies of all time, like literally top five, Whole Buddy Affair, put it in there. So I guess you have to say it's my favorite Tarantino?
Yeah, I mean, it's the weird one because this is like, for me, the turning point in Tarantino's entire filmography, to where like he makes Reservoir Dogs, he makes Pulp Fiction, he makes Jackie Brown, but those all seem like they're sort of unified in terms of tone and style. And then he goes away for what, 5 years?
7 years.
7 years.
Yeah.
And it's
for
like,
six, yeah.
And he doesn't make a movie, or he spends all that time basically developing Kill Bill. And like, I guess the other thing to point out, too, is that this is a movie that comes from a different time period in terms of production and also covering movies, and that this was like being produced at the height of like the Ain't It Cool News kind of era. So like in that gap between Jackie Brown and Kill Bill, all this stuff starts to leak out to where like the like what was it, like 254 page
yeah,
like handwritten script for Kill Bill. There were all these rumors about them, you know, the Weinstein sending Tarantino overseas, that he's learning how to basically shoot action on the fly. He's working with, you know, Wen Yuping after they, you know, he just worked on both Crouching Tiger and The Matrix.
Yeah.
And The Matrix really catapults him to like superstardom. And so it's like there's this whole stew kind of brewing in the absence of Tarantino that makes the anticipation for this movie at an all-time high. Then the movie plays at Cannes. You get the Whole Buddy Affair cut that's 4.5 hours long, and then you hear about it getting cut into two movies. And that's how we all pretty much saw it for the first time.
Yeah, I remember I was in film school as a sophomore when the fall and spring. And it was this weird thing of like, there were those douchebags. I had a professor, I remember, who was an interim professor who no one liked. And he was one of the, he was just like, I don't see the big deal with Tarantino. And we all almost like jumped on him like feral wolves. And because we're all like 19 years old in fucking film school. Most of us are there because we love Tarantino. Like he was like of that era that I think a lot of us, me in particular, fell in love with, like wanting to be a filmmaker, like seeing something like Pulp Fiction, like at like the age of like 11. And I remember just waiting and waiting. Same thing. It was like, I remember hearing about The Bride and all, and then there was the rumors of the Vega Brothers movie and all this stuff. We were all waiting for what's next from him. And then for it to be as amazing, even cut into two as it was mind-blowing. And for me, just rewatching this in the theater, I hadn't seen it since pre-COVID. And I used to watch it all the fucking time. Like, it was a movie I had on repeat, especially in college when the DVDs came out. And it's like, oh, yeah, this is fucking great. Like, it's just like, it was great to have the distance and watch it in one fell swoop like this. Mm-hmm. And just be reminded of, like, oh, here's this masterpiece of, like, how did this fucking get made? How did this get a budget? This crazy, gory, just fucking full Tarantino, everything he loves. I think of it almost like his Raiders of the Lost Ark, of, like, all the things he loves about all these genres that, you know, he grew up on, thrown into one movie.
Right. And how did you experience Kill Bill for the first time? Like, where were you at in your life when Volume 1 comes out? Because that's how you saw it, right? You didn't see the canned cut when it first premiered?
No, I didn't see the canned cut until I moved to Los Angeles and I played at the New Beverly. I was living in Portland, Oregon, you know, and I saw it at Fox Tower, downtown Portland. And, you know, saw it three times over that first opening weekend. And then saw part two. By that time, I was doing a little bit of writing for Reel.com. And so I started getting invited to press screenings. So they had multiple press screenings of Volume 2 in Portland. And so I saw it twice, even before it opened.
And I think for clarification, I think anybody who's going to listen to this podcast is going to know what the whole Buddy Affair is. But, like, what I found leading up to this release, in talking to, I guess, quote unquote, normal people, is that for us, this was like a monumental event when we were growing up as like cinephiles and stuff, and that like tracking this movie being made, anticipating a new Tarantino film, and then it playing at Cannes in this 4.5-hour cut, and then the Weinsteins basically forcing him to cut it into two movies because they basically said, like, we can't sell a 4.5-hour movie.
I mean, there was another layer there, too, where the movie came in way over budget.
Yeah.
You get two bites of the apple with cutting it in half. And that's really why Tarantino, you know, agreed with it, because it was the only way for them to recoup their money.
Yeah.
You know, which he had overspent. And while he probably didn't feel too guilty about it, there still was.
Okay, I don't think he feels guilty about much.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
I don't think that man's ever experienced
regret.
Absolutely not. Paul Dano, fuck off. But it's like, it was cut into two movies, but like, I guess if you were there, for lack of a better term, like, this was a huge deal, but this almost feels like, when I was talking to, like, you know, a dude who, you know, works with me at the bar and stuff, is like, he's like, man, that's crazy that there's like a new cut of Kill Bill and like there's new scenes in it and stuff. And he's like, and it's like, you know, I didn't realize that it, you know, it could be one movie, or, you know, that's basically all it is. And you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. No, that's not what this is. Like, and you explain it to somebody, and like, just watching his face be like, when you actually explain the history about the whole Buddy Affair to them, is that they're like, I had no idea that that was a thing. And that got me thinking about how Tarantino, like, we talk about like Ridley Scott and James Cameron and stuff being like the great tinkerers and like the guys who are known for the director's cuts and everything. Like, Quentin Tarantino now is quickly becoming the guy who has the most, let's say, tampered with versions of his movies, to where, or maybe like there's a compromise in putting them out to a certain degree, because like after this, you have Grindhouse, which kind of the same exact thing happens to where it's released as one long movie and then split up as two, to your point, almost like double dip and recoup finances, because that movie was a massive failure.
It did not do well.
And then you also have, I mean, the one Tarantino movie I revisited before we recorded this was Hateful Eight. In that Hateful Eight, you have the Roadshow version, which played in like 70 millimeter. You had a 35 millimeter version, which was slightly shorter. And then it was cut into a Netflix miniseries, which was essentially like the Roadshow version that was shown in 70, but like with a little more added in, and then turned into four distinct chapters. By the way, I rewatched Hateful Eight in the 4-something-hour version. That movie has aged like fine fucking wine. I love it so much.
It's been a minute for me.
It's so nasty.
Yeah.
I mean, Grindhouse was released theatrically
As what? Yeah. Right,
as the whatever the 3.5 hour experience, and that's one of the reasons why it bombed is that nobody there wasn't a huge audience for straight exploitation being sold as straight exploitation.
Yeah.
And on top of it, you're making people sit in the theater
for 3.5 hours. Yeah.
So then on home video, then they like DVD, they were, you know, we're going to release it as separate movies. And I don't think it was until Blu-ray where Grindhouse got a home proper entertainment release.
Well, there was, I remember the first version ever that restored it on home video was a Japanese, like, 6-disc version that I bought and had imported because it was the only way that you could watch at home the full, like, Grindhouse experience cut with, like, the fake trailers by, you know, Eli Roth and Rob Zombie and everything put in. But I guess that leads me to another question for you guys is that, like, we talk about Tarantino both, like, you were just talking about Martin. You went to film school, you know, while Tarantino was kind of at the height of his powers, like coming out, and how he's such a huge inspiration. I guess my question is, we talk about Tarantino as being like this gateway drug kind of artist who, like, you know, everybody after Pulp Fiction started seeking out like Fernando de Leo movies and stuff. And like, it's that he brought that sense of being a video store kid to the actual like production of his movies. For me, I feel like Kill Bill is an even bigger gateway drug movie because, like, he started basically introducing the idea of, like, having people seek out, like, Shaw Brothers movies and seek out, like, you know, Lucio Fulci's Zombie to do the comparison to, like, the live burial scene with the bride or spaghetti westerns.
Yeah, Sergio Leone.
Yeah. Finding old Gordon Liu movies, finding, you know, copies of Kung Fu, the series that you could watch and things like that.
Street Fighter, Sonny Chiba, and
Is this a bigger gateway drug than his first films?
In terms of opening up to more movies?
Right.
Yes. I think that his first run, in particular for me, Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, was a gateway drug to like cool cinema in a way. Like, I think before that I was really into big summer tent poles and stuff as a kid, you know, and it was like Batman, which I still love. And that was my first introduction to, like, I thought of it as indie filmmaking in a way. Like, that's, I saw it through that lens. But I think in terms of, like, oh my God, there's so much amazing shit out there, especially in a kind of not pre-internet, but not the internet we have today. And also not having media through streaming available. You had to seek this shit out.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of the stuff that he references, you're like, I couldn't even find it.
Well, and I think it what's good is that it happens and coincides with the rise of, like, repertory lines and DVDs with, like, Anchor Bay, Blue Underground, all these guys that we reference time and time again in terms of our home media collections, is that, like, you could seek out Lucio Fulci's Zombie, and you could seek out, like, 8-Diagram Pole Fighter and things like that, because, like, labels were starting to put stuff like this out, so it made it a little more accessible. But also, like, to James's point, there is a big difference. It almost, like, Tarantino and Rodriguez themselves kind of misinterpreted their own appeal in terms of, like, there was a difference between, like, making their own versions of Grindhouse movies and how marketable those were versus, like, just being like, hey, I referenced this in Kill Bill. Go seek out the Blu-ray now.
Yeah, because I wonder about the failure of Grindhouse in particular, the movie of that. I remember them talking and they're saying, we wanted to make two films that were a Grindhouse poster, which was always better than the movie, and we're going to do it for real with a budget.
Right.
I think a movie's like Rotor, personally, of like, what a great poster. It looks like Mad Max 3. It's not. You know, the budget's like $15.
Or like all the Jack Hill movies that Tarantino was obsessed with, which are admittedly very good films, but like their posters made them seem way bigger than they actually were.
And more epic. And I think like that's the kind of, what's interesting is the success of Kill Bill and the failure of Grindhouse. Like, I think that Kill Bill is just also an actually narrative that grabs you. Like there's a complete tongue-in-cheek nature to Grindhouse for me, both those films.
Yeah, there's a distancing effect to it.
Versus Kill Bill, I actually get emotionally very moved by when I watch that film in many instances.
I mean, we were talking at the very beginning about the departure from the first three Tarantino films to this one. And for me, there's two big things that mark that departure even more than, you know, he went and became an action filmmaker. I mean, part of it is around the action. So the first three movies were incredibly elaborate with the narrative, right? It's told in a non-linear way. You know, you have these setups in the film where the payoff is built upon layers and layers of narrative. So, like, the big set pieces, like in Jackie Brown, you know, when you get to the actual quote-unquote heist in that film, right, it's not like an action scene. You know, it's built around, you know, again, a layered narrative. Kill Bill, you still have a layered narrative and you still have the complexity, you know, with his narrative, the way he tells his stories. But now you're layering in these incredible action scenes. There's a 45-minute one right in the film. I mean, even the small ones, you know, by the time you get to Kill Bill and it's like these two blonde Amazon 6-foot-tall women throwing themselves at each other in a tiny trailer and destroying the trailer, that scene's probably like 2 or 3 minutes, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's not anywhere near the House of Blue scene, like Blue Leaf scene, which is like amazing.
Yeah.
But maybe my favorite fight is the one with Daryl Hannah and Uma Thurman throwing themselves around in that trailer. The action in that, again, is so incredible, but it's also still built on that, you know, complexity of the narrative. The other piece for me was, you know, if you think about, like, auteur theory, right, and, you know, what came out of, like, the study, you know, that built the French New Wave movement and this appreciation of the filmmaker of, like, this all, you know, encompassing creative force in these movies, you know, and Tarantino certainly fits that bill, right, for the first three films. But now you start to have this conversation with Kill Bill with auteur theory, that how can you have, you know, this type of filmmaker who is an auteur, but he's so blatantly, like, influenced by other films in the way that he's just taking chunks of those films and just putting them in the movie. You know, his other movies have scores and soundtracks, but this one is largely made up of sound clips from other movies. So it really is a step from Jackie Brown and Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, which, you know, like, real movie nerds, you know, who knew City of Fire could recognize the similarities in Reservoir Dogs to, you know, on City on Fire. But the overtness in Kill Bill changed the way that somebody can think about auteur theory. And that was the first time that, you know, sort of, like, happened in my lifetime.
I also think, like, to James's point, in terms of, like, when you watched Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, and Jackie Brown, those were all, I guess for lack of a better term, they all felt like valley movies, like in the same way that Paul Thomas Anderson's, like, early movies.
Yeah, or like, you know, Licorice Pizza. Like, yeah.
Like, they all kind of exist in this shared sort of universe. But, I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson kind of does the same thing when he breaks away after Magnolia and comes back. He kind of has the same exact moment that Tarantino does with Kill Bill with There Will Be Blood, is that he disappears for a little while and comes back with this thing that's unlike anything else that we've seen this guy do before, both on, like, a storytelling and performance kind of level, but also just on a pure, like, formal level. Like, nobody saw this hard Kubrickian period piece coming from Paul Thomas Anderson, you know, after Punch Drunk Love. You know what I mean? And, like, with Kill Bill, Kill Bill opens the door to, I always like the quote from Tarantino himself to where he talked about, you know, Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, and Jackie Brown all kind of exist in their own universe. But then Kill Bill, Django Unchained, the Grindhouse films,
Inglourious Bastards.
Inglourious Bastards all are almost like movies that the Wallaces would go out and see on a date together. You know, and that there's the Grindhouse universe that he creates versus the real world, quote unquote, like Tarantino universe. And I like that because, like, without Kill Bill and him being able to take that huge swing, like, you wouldn't have Django Unchained. You wouldn't have the Grindhouse movies. You certainly wouldn't have, like, Hateful Eight. Or, like, anything that kind of comes after to where, like, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood almost feels, for as much as I think that that's still his best movie, like, that feels like a retreat back to his original form of storytelling, you know, just with, by doing almost, like, his version of, like, historical fiction.
Well, and Red Apples is the thing that connects all the movies.
Right. But Red Apples also, that also appears in Hateful Eight.
Right.
That's when it starts to get muddied, is that you're like...
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm just emphasizing your point that it just, you know, there is a departure from those early movies. The only thing that ends up connecting all the movies is...
The Red Apple cigarettes.
Well, it is interesting, too, when you... We were talking on the way to see Avatar at that press screening, Matt. We were talking to that screening, Jacob, about seeing Avatar and how Tarantino is his own brand, right? That he's sold, or and
we have very few guys who are just like, as a filmmaker, like also a brand.
And Nolan is the other one, and it is the kind of thing where a lot of people are like, they will go see whatever they make. It can be, you know, adaptation of The Odyssey or whatever they're making, right?
I think to a lesser degree, PTA is too.
Agreed. I think for, especially in like film quote bro culture, like he's one of the ones.
Fincher,
Fincher.
I think there's more than you think. You know, like Jordan Peele.
Yeah.
You know, like the advertising around his movies is built around Jordan Peele.
I mean, the advertising around the movies that Jordan Peele even produces, like him.
Exactly.
Like hinge on from the mind of Jordan Peele.
I mean, we have crossed over to a point where, you know, younger cinephiles, you know, have really bought into these filmmakers. And they are a significant reason why people are going to see Robert Eggers movies, especially in that 25 to 45 demo.
Yeah.
They're going to see it because it's Robert Eggers. They're not going because of the cast. They're not going because of the genre. They're going because it's Robert Eggers.
Well, I think what I was thinking, though, is about what people did think and now think about when they say Tarantino. I'm talking about fans, but also just like people who maybe don't want to watch his movies, right? And the first three films... as a fan, but also the way people talked back even before Kill Bill came out was it was all about the dialogue. It was about Tarantino dialogue. Those films were violent, but they were not talked out of being uber. They're not uber violent when you get compared to what we get to later on. The kind of almost like cartoonish.
And Kill Bill's like kind of the turning point with that is without House of Blue Leaves, you don't have like the massive shootout in like Django.
Right. And I, those moments, and you start to expect it. And then Glorious Bastards, you have, you know, crazy action and gory scenes as well. And that's why I think it's so interesting is my favorite is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as well, is that you don't have a violent movie until the very, very end where it's this countdown to a real life, like you said, true crime murder that I remember seeing this for the first time and I said, oh my God, they're going to show it. Like, I did not think he was going to change
it. Me neither.
I don't think a lot of us did. And we were jumping out of our chairs with glee when Brad Pitt starts murdering these fucking hippies.
Right.
You know, so it's like he bounces back to the new version of Tarantino, this explosive violence. You know what I'm saying?
Well, that's the Hitler moment.
Yeah,
right.
100%.
Of like it, at the what end, if we it's, could stop it's his it. Revisionist yeah. history of like, what if these heroes that I created could actually, you know, alter the course of time itself. Like, it's kind of the ultimate instance of like Tarantino's mega ego is that he's like, here are my creations literally murdering Hitler and Manson.
Well, you also have, you know, him playing with the two sides again of like this dialogue driven guy, the story, you said, this narrative playfulness like you're talking about, you know, James, and you definitely get that with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
But what's interesting, too, is you have that jump into violence in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. With Kill Bill, you have, like, the inverse. The end of the movie, of The Whole Bloody Affair, is you think it's going to be a huge showdown with Bill. And not to jump ahead, but you have this dialogue scene. It's this emotional... It switches the other way.
That actually is a good segue into the question I have for both of you, is that, like, especially for the people who here who haven't had a chance to watch Whole Bloody Affair yet, because, like James, I had the chance to see the can cut. Like, this wasn't the first time with me seeing this version of the movie, which is, like, technically different than the version that even played at Cannes, too, is that Exhumed, of course, brought the can print that originally premiered in France.
It was Tarantino's print, right?
Tarantino's print. I think the only print that exists of it, with the burned yellow French subtitles on it and everything. Like, they played it in Philly for a 4-day weekend, if memory serves. I had a couple friends who literally went every single day to see it, and I saw it on 35 millimeter there, and it is a totally different experience watching it as a whole, for me at least, and this is what I wanted to open it up to you guys too, is that, like, I think the changes that are made for the Whole Bloody Affair are what makes Kill Bill arguably his best movie as a whole, to where, like, taken as two parts, the flaws are a little more apparent.
There's added scenes, right? And there's added dialogue. But for me, the remarkable thing is, and I think you can actually study this, is they take out one line.
Yeah.
It's that one line that gets taken out that completely changes the entire film.
It's the cliffhanger line.
Right. It's the cliffhanger line. So it becomes an entirely different emotional experience watching that movie, if you're watching it through the bride, so we do not know.
Yeah, you as an audience member not knowing until the very end when BB appears that her daughter is alive the entire time. I couldn't imagine what a shock it was to actually be in that original can audience. Like, I feel like that, I hate to be like a real hipster douchebag, but like, I mean, that would be
too late.
Pretty on brand for me, but like, the only people who have ever had a pure experience watching this movie is that original can audience, like, and seeing it the way that Tarantino intended and having like the purest emotional response to it.
That's some Walter Benjamin original artifact
theory
shit, which I love,
but I mean, like, that's honestly how I feel about it, because like, going into Whole Bloody Affair, you know, for most people, like, they've already seen Kill Bill Volume 1 and Volume 2. At this point, like, this is very much like a novelty release of four, like, cinephiles themselves on, like, riding on the back of one of the biggest name filmmakers that we have. Is that, like, anybody going to watch this movie has probably already seen these. And so they know at the end, regardless of what the changes are, that BB's alive the whole time, and it's all leading to this final confrontation with Bill and meeting her daughter again.
Well, I knew that you had hinted at years ago when we were first talking about the possibility of this cut coming out and how you both had seen it. And I was trying to put myself back to a mindset of, like, and again, it had been a couple years. I had a good time, like, just being like, you know what? I'm going to try to watch this through new eyes. Like, I'm watching this film for the first time, which is difficult. But I will say, like, putting myself, following my protagonist was a really, not only that change and, like, how big it makes the end punch, for me, was the middle of the film works so much better, because when you watch Kill Bill Volume 2, you kind of jump right into everything with Bud, right? And when I first saw that, I said, wow, like, really not even getting a lot of, like, action with her yet. Like, you have to kind of wait for her to come back. That's how I remember it, right?
Well, there's the massacre. Right.
The first chapter is the, you know, massacre at Two Pines.
The massacre, so you get that. But then, yeah, to your point, it jumps to Bud in the trailer and Bill coming in and visiting him.
Right. Well, yeah, you're completely right. So my point is that you're not getting the further adventures of the bride right now.
Right.
Like, you're not really sure where she's at.
Despite the fact that, to James's point, it's another excision here in the original two cuts, is that you have basically like Tarantino's version of like the previously on,
right,
the black and white stuff where she's driving and she's narrating directly to the camera to basically catch the audience up to where, like, this is where the narrative is now, and then you go to the black and white chapel massacre.
Right. And what I really liked about this time around, I don't know what it was, and I think it was the fact that it had been a while, was everything with Bud hit me completely differently. And,
dude, Madsen's so fucking good in this movie.
And I think that, again, going in, I think when I was younger, I took it more as like, oh, it's just Tarantino, it's just so cool. You know what I mean? Which
right.
It is. It's fucking cool. This time I was, again, so much more emotionally engaged with a lot of different characters, but in particular, everything with Bud, of his, how he's, he to me almost represents the path that she could have taken. If you're a killer, if you are, you know, a full assassin with the skill, with a Hatari Hanzo sword, all these things, and you give it up to basically have a normal life, you fall apart. And watching it this time, he was so sad. Like, it was hilarious.
It's deeply sad.
But it's so fucking somber.
But he hasn't, like, he didn't step away. He lost it.
Yeah,
I mean, I think
right.
that's the distinction between what the bride is doing, you know, and what has happened to him, is that, you know, I mean, there's a reason why there's that scene in the film where he goes to work,
yeah,
and then gets reamed, you know, and thrown out, you know, and, like, that's the scene in the film that is unusual, I think, from everything else, which is, like, you know, super empowering for at least one of the characters. This is a moment where it's like the opposite, you know.
You're a loser.
Right. It's emphasizing he goes home, you know, and he puts on his sad records, you know, and he just sits in his chair and he just drinks. He's lost everything. So you can have sympathy for that character just because you generally have sympathy for these, like, movie characters that have lost everything.
Well, and he, you know, I think just the symbolism of, like, he still has the sword hit me hard this time, of, like, the whole thing. He's like,
in the golf bag.
Yeah, but he, you know, you hawked the Hattori Hanzo, and it's hilarious.
That's priceless.
And yeah. He's like, I got, you know, $250.
Yeah. Not in El Paso.
You know, but I love the idea that he still has it, like, there's a part of him that's alive. And also, he's the only one who bests the bride. Like, if he had killed her differently, she's dead. Like, he got her. You know, and so it is this interesting thing, because he was this wounded animal that I think she sees as not as much of a threat.
Well, I also think that it's also not so much that, for me at least, my interpretation of Bud has always been slightly different from your guys's, is that, like, to me, he's not a guy who's lost it. He's a guy who's literally, like, lives in the shadow of, like, regret, to where it's like
right.
All the sins that they've committed actually weighed on him. He's the only one with a viable conscience in the end, who, like, has been driven to working as a fucking bouncer in a titty bar, cleaning toilets, drinking at home. He's almost like Riggs in that way, to where, like, he's a guy who was, like, an instrument of violence, who, like, the mental toll of it kind of caught up with him, to where, like, now all he does is drink in his trailer and think about, like, the choices that he's made that have, like, led up to this point in his life.
But I mean, I need the scene where, again, your boss is telling you how incompetent you are and what
sure.
a fuck up you are.
Sure.
I mean, he could be a fuck up, right, because of all these regrets, you know, and he could have lost it because of these regrets too. But I mean, I think there still is that distinction with his character that he's failed.
I'd see, the other thing that I always take with the fuck up line, and that incredible scene with Larry Bishop.
Oh my God.
Where he has the stripper do the blow, be somebody, baby. Right. Like,
the most right. Jacob line. I literally turned to him during the movie. I was like, this is the most you line of all time.
But, like, yeah. Thank you, I guess.
It is very you.
I am Larry.
Are
Bishop.
You telling me that you're as useless as an asshole right here?
But he, so the moment where he starts doing, it's calendar time for Buddy. Like, and he starts cutting his days and stuff, and even going, like, you don't even know what fucking day you work. to me, the other interpretation of that scene is also like, Bud could kill this guy if he wanted to, but he chooses not to. To where, like, he chooses this life of, like, destitution and alcoholism and everything because of the way that this shit kind of weighs on him. Because at any moment, he could just fucking snap Larry Bishop's neck.
Which
so, what then what's the reason for him to want to change that and get the money?
What do you mean?
I mean, he's... When he gets the bride, right, he's going to perform the acts that, you know, these people that he used to be with but are no longer with, they want. He's going to do that in exchange for $1 million.
Right. Well, and he's giving the sword up for $1 million.
I mean, he's going to keep his sword.
No, this the other. He's gonna
no, he's selling it to Daryl Hannah.
He's selling the bride.
The bride sword.
And the bride sword to Daryl Hannah.
Like, but to me, it's just him. I think it's also what once a vulture, always a vulture. Like, if you put an opportunity to make $1 million in front of anybody, especially a scumbag, they're going to fucking take it.
Well, but, I mean, as you were, I mean, it's the same thing where, you know, he's choosing not to kill his boss.
Right.
And he can. Like there has to be a reason why now if he has decided to become, you know, this hermit, then he has to not be that hermit anymore if he's going to want this money.
So I think that's ultimately what you are kind of pointing out is also sort of the flaw in the film, in that some of the characters, like Vivica A. Fox's character in the beginning, is almost kind of like a sketch of where Vernita Green would end up after being, like, what if one of these assassins just wants to give it all up and become a suburban housewife? Right. Like, there's not a whole lot else to her, but at least to your point, that part is consistent to where I think Bud is almost like the sad, gross, drunk version of Vernita Green, but it is, like, it's not exactly thoroughly sketched or consistently sketched the entire time. Because, I mean, the same with, like, Oren Ishii, if you didn't have the
backstory,
frankly, it's tough to call anything in a 4.5 hour movie too long. But the new anime extended sequence, I gotta tell you, it's the only time where we were sitting in the movie theater where I was like, all right, we could speed this up like a little bit.
All I felt for that scene was, oh, I haven't seen this before. Like that, it was the whole, like, I felt like I was watching a deleted scene versus,
oh, like the pretty Ricky stuff?
Yeah, that I'm happy to have this added. But I will say about Bud is, and I get what you're saying about it being a little inconsistent, is that, is the scene with his boss, with Lair Drake, and it's interesting to interpret that way, I've never seen it that way, because for me, his performance is so slouchy.
Oh yeah.
That, to your point, it's like he's lost it. Like, even if he wanted to, I don't think he could kick his ass. Like, the way that he gets the bride is rock salt in a shotgun. It's not in a fucking sword fight. Like, that part of him is gone.
I'm not saying that he's just gonna throw fisticuffs with Larry Bishop at that moment, but I think that's kind of my point, is that, like, he's clever enough that, to your point, he's also able to be the only one who gets the drop on the bride. And all it takes is a shotgun and some rock salt and, like, a pretty crudely designed trap. Like, what's to stop him from doing the same thing that Larry Bishop in his car in the parking lot at 3 a.m. when the strip club lets out?
That's true.
It's like, I'm not saying that he could he's just going to throw down with him, but it's like, the guy clearly still has it. It's like, that's where the inconsistency that James is pointing out sort of flies, is that if he's lost it, how's he the only one who's able to capture the bride?
Well, but I don't think it's an inconsistency. I mean, I think he doesn't have these abilities. I think he's lost it. I think that, you know, again, that's the only consistent reading for this character, you know. And, yeah.
That he's just, like, washed up.
Right. He's, like, the reason he is where he is because he's a failure at it. You know, that he's lost. He's fucked up.
I mean, I like that, too. Either way, I think it is, at the end of the day, just very sad.
Right.
And it's also one of Madsen's, I mean, obviously, Mr. Blonde is forever Madsen's greatest performance. Right. But, like, Bud, pretty close second.
I mean, when he passed away, the prevalent, you know, meme was the Kill Bill you know, she deserves a revenge, and we all deserve to die.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I mean,
it is an incredible line reading.
I'll tell you, he's also really, really good in Hateful Eight. Like, it's a very odd... I think all of the performances in that movie are, like, almost, like, mega... borderline, like, Brechtian theater because they're so big. Particularly, like, Tim Roth's code-switching English hangman is, like, one of the strangest, most theatrical performances maybe in all of Tarantino's filmography. But, like... And Madsen's very, very good at the end when he's just sucking on that candy and drinking the brandy. And like, and then when it does the reverse kind of point of view where you're watching all the events again, but you're watching them from Joe Gage's perspective being like, I'm going to get that motherfucker. You know, like you actually believe it because Madsen's still like, he's so much in line from like a modern standpoint with the people that or the actors and performers that Tarantino was clearly in love with from the 70s.
The Lee Marvins,
the Tommy Lee Joneses in Rolling Thunder, guys like that, to where like we just don't produce that type of man anymore.
Well, it's the whole joke in Reservoir Dogs. I bet you're a real Lee Marvin fan.
Exactly.
And it's just like they even lean into it.
I mean, in his book, he doesn't like Point Blank, though, so, I mean...
It's true. It's a really weird...
It's a weird odd...
But, I mean, this is, like, the ultimate thing, is when people are basically getting mad at Tarantino for talking shit about Paul Dano, talking shit about Matthew Lillard, just throwing nonsense opinions out there, is that it's almost kind of like, did you guys just get here? Like, is this your first day?
What do you mean you don't like Point Blank?
It's like, this guy, like he literally has an entire book and reportedly a second book coming that I'm sure has even more weird opinions. It's just like, that's what this guy is known for. Getting mad at him for it is like getting mad at like M&Ms for having chocolate inside of them.
He's an expert shit talker. I mean, we saw him. We talked about this when we did the full Tarantino episode, but we saw him do his For the Cinema Speculation Tour. Horrible night. And
legendary secret handshake night where we've brought it up so many times. Worst presentation I've ever sat through.
It was, man. And Jacob's like, can we leave? Like I said, I paid $100 for this. We're staying.
We're staying. I was like, you know, 30 of that went to the book, right?
Oh, God. But, you know, he also, it's funny because he is like, it was like we were reading the interview with Cameron. He's another guy who just doesn't fucking give a shit.
Master shit talker.
Just, they're both good shit talkers.
The fucking goat. Like, the man is now being like, I wrote Point Blank. Or I wrote Point Break.
Yeah, we're talking about Cameron here. Right. Yeah,
so it's it's just kind of like, damn, dude. I gave a mouse CPR. And then I let Ed Harris die.
Mr. Cameron, I didn't like the film transfer for... You know, The Abyss. Shut the fuck up. Do you know how much work I put into those 4K releases?
I mean, I really think, not to get too far off on a tangent, but it's like, we should bring public shit talking back. Like, the days of, like, everybody being so sensitive, not to sound like some, like, incel or MAGA, like, weirdo or whatever, but it's like, seriously, it's so much better when our public figures are just playfully talking shit on one another. Like, look at Timmy Chalamet right now.
Oh.
Just on a legendary press tour for Marty Supreme. Just saying nonsense. He's like, I want to be the GOAT. I want to be all time. I want to be like LeBron James. He's going on fucking College Game Day and shit. This is what we need. We need more of this and less like, I think he's pretty good. Like, let's all get along. Like, no. Call people out. Like, I want, like, you know, I want Brad Pitt. Well, maybe not Brad Pitt because he's... He's got some issues of his own. Like, Javier Bardem. Like, let's have him, like, you know, throwing down and yelling at, like, other Latino actors and being like, I am, you know, the greatest Latino actor of all time. Like, I would just love to see that. And then Antonio Banderas, like, steps in the ring. They throw down. It's awesome.
I just also like the return of people like Jacob Elordi, who also hates the paparazzi. And it's just, I love that where it's like, just get out of my fucking face. I just like that level of star.
Yeah, start punching TMZ dudes.
Yeah.
Like, seriously. Like, they deserve it. But, I mean, I will say on a more positive note, sitting through Kill Bill, Whole Buddy Affair, I was in tears for, like, I don't know. We'll just put a number to it, roughly 50% of it. And it wasn't necessarily just an emotional reaction, but it was because this movie is so transportive to like a very particular time of watching films, that sense of discovery that kind of came along with Tarantino's real rise to popularity. Because that's, I mean, it is one of the things I do think gets lost in the narrative as he blew up to become this kind of mega auteur, is that like, we didn't have anybody like him, and we didn't have anybody opening these doors to other avenues of like cinephilia and stuff. And like, that was a real rush. And like, watching these movies again, like, I was back sitting in that suburban Pennsylvania theater where I helped build the print for Kill Bill Volume 1. And we would literally stay up all night. Like, we would unhook, you know, those projectors that you would play like the local ads on. We would literally unhook that and hook a Blu-ray player up to that and play our own like exhumed films, like double and triple features and stuff, and sit up all night and smoke weed and cigarettes and drink beer in the theater and do whatever. But it was like, it was that sense of discovery that came along with that time period in my life, is that like sitting through this, like, it really moved me in almost like a Proustian way of like transporting me back to being in those theaters again and smoking those Camel Lights and like drinking shitty beer and being like, wow, I've never seen, you know, Cannibal Holocaust or any of these again, because like, it just, that part like really of time, like really shaped my brain.
I mean, De Palma was the closest we had.
Right.
Until Tarantino. And I think Scorsese now.
Right.
Has done so much work in boosting, you know, other films and restoring foreign language films.
Well, like his, you know, World Criterion Cinema project, yeah, that he does and stuff.
Yeah, like he's become a gateway, you know, just because he's, you know, one of the leading film academics, in the world.
I'm actually glad that you used that word, because I do want to say that I do see the main difference between Tarantino and like a Martin Scorsese, is that, for lack of a better term, the movies Tarantino isn't introducing you to feel less like homework, yeah, than the stuff Scorsese's showing you. Like, a lot of that is like classic movies and putting a lot of like cerebral thought into it, where like Tarantino's like, you know what's fucking awesome? Like, yeah, Five Fingers of Death. Yeah. You know, like there's a real like kind of entertainer quality to him.
Right. Well, I mean, God bless the fact that Scorsese loves exploitation movies, you know. But you're right. He's championing, you know, again, movies that are 3 hours long, and it's about, you know, a docudrama about this poor boy in a South American prison.
Yeah.
But I remember...
not exactly Friday night viewing.
But I remember in high school I got his... it was The History of Cinema... the multi-hour documentary he did about the history of American cinema. And it was given, our family friend gave it to me. He's like, oh, you're a film guy, you got to watch this. And that was cool.
Because, is this the My Journey Through Cinema one?
A personal journey through American films.
I still have that DVD. But that one,
me too.
That one was the, I would literally just write down movies he talked about, because while he is talking about serious film, he also introduced me to a lot of Westerns I never heard of before.
Oh, sure.
Like, he's a big program. He's a guy who like loves a Bud Bedeker, a programmer guy.
Look, I'm in no way talking on Scorsese.
I know you're not.
Because I think both are equally valuable and important.
I think we're all in agreement, right? There's a distinction there.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Scorsese is not putting... This is what I was talking about earlier about like this change in the way I think you can look at auteur theory. In, you know, again, Scorsese is an auteur. He very much fulfills all the things needed to put him in that category. Tarantino is too. He's just now, with Kill Bill, making it completely obvious where these influences are coming from, to the point where he's scoring the film with stuff that's directly being taken out of other movies. You know, like, you have, you know, all the spaghetti Western cues, right, that are in the, you know, this movie. Like, again, this book that I have, it's the Kill Bill Official Casebook by D.K. Holm. This was like my bathroom reading for years and years after Kill Bill, because he extensively goes through each and every influence in the film and tells you what it is. And so this was my, you know, gateway to all these other films was, you know, first the movie and then somebody with the knowledge of pointing me in the direction of where this is all coming from.
Oh,
so
totally.
How did I learn who Sergio Corbucci is and how did I fall in love with these movies? Well, it was because of, you know, Kill Bill. And it was because of DK Holm pointing it out that this is where this is coming from.
And then guys like Bill Lustig making those movies available to you on, like, Blue Underground.
Thank you, Bill.
You guys want to get to questions?
Yes.
All right. Now we're back with questions about Kill Bill, The Whole Bloody Affair. Martin, top three Tarantino, do it.
I would do Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, number one. Now Kill Bill, Bloody Affair is one, as number two. And then number three, I'm going to do Pulp Fiction.
James?
Whole Bloody Affair and Glorious Bastards and Reservoir Dogs.
Damn. Fired that one off like he's been thinking about it for years.
Mm-hmm. He has.
I'm Hollywood, Whole Bloody Affair, and Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, same as me.
You know, it's tough to, like, kind of knock off the holy trifecta there.
Yeah.
So, man, we can't really do remake, redo, streaming series. I guess we could talk about, do you think, we were talking about something, I guess, in place of that question, before we started recording, about the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood miniseries that was rumored for, like, a long time that had a bunch of extra footage that you were supposed to do for Netflix. Do we still think that exists?
I don't know if it ever existed.
Do you think it was just more Tarantino shit talk?
I mean, he does that all the time.
That's
if
what
there's
I mean.
Extra footage, it's pretty unusual for, you know, his, like, post Kill Bill movies. Like,
I just wonder if there's going to be something released Once Upon a Time in Hollywood related around the time next year of
the
continuing
sequel.
Adventures of Cliff Booth.
I mean,
well, I just wonder if they do something with the original to get it back in the consciousness too.
I mean, the sequel in theory does that.
Right.
But I mean, do they, you know, is there a souped-up version of it? Then, yeah.
It's kind of like, did we need a miniseries cut of The Hateful Eight? No. Am I glad that it exists? 100%.
Yeah.
And the pacing of Once Upon a Time is just so perfect for me. Like, for a longer movie, that movie fucking flies by.
Well, there was also talk about him doing a Bounty Law series for Netflix.
Right.
Which sounds like the worst idea possible, if we're being completely honest.
I mean, there's apparently scripts for it.
Yeah.
But here's my question. I mean, like, did Hateful Eight, you know, Netflix cut, did that, you know...
Did it move the needle?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Exactly.
I don't work on Netflix.
Yeah.
Also, I don't understand their data. So, like, maybe? I mean, it's a big enough deal that they're... I do think it's significant that Fincher is directing the sequel from a script by Tarantino, and that Tarantino, obviously notorious theater guy, like, is allowing that to happen? Like, I do find that curious.
I mean, they're going to... There's got to be something in a clause that they're going to have a huge theatrical release for it, or close to Frankenstein at least.
I mean, Frankenstein wasn't a huge.
Not huge, but yeah. Like,
yeah. It'll be on the same level. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it'll play. It'll probably be some special engagements or whatever. But
I mean,
like,
yeah, the issue with Netflix is really if you can get the scale to the point where you can get the chain theaters involved, but they also just don't spend marketing dollars.
Yeah.
You know, to drive traffic to theaters.
Yeah, because they don't care.
Yeah, because they don't care. But, I mean, like, Hateful Eight was a disappointment at the box office because he had gone through a string of, like, really significant hits.
And that was a real downturn for him financially.
The box office didn't
work. There
was
also the fiasco with that one, too, though, to where, like, they were installing all the projectors and stuff around the country.
They were
trying to do
a lot,
the Rose show. The prints were breaking.
Right.
It was one of those where it was, like, really great in theory, but the actual execution of it, they forgot that for the last decade since digital cinema had basically taken over theaters, that the majority of theaters, like, don't have actual projectionists to run this shit.
Well, but, I mean, Inglourious Basterds on, the one that sticks out is not working with, like, literally the biggest stars on the planet at the time is Hateful Eight.
Right.
You know, like, starting with Inglourious, you got Brad Pitt, you know, and he wanted Will Smith for
Django,
and, you know, got Jamie Foxx, but then he got Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah.
You know, so that's probably the biggest reason why the box office for Hateful Eight didn't work. But I think that's going to translate over to the Netflix version. Like, if people didn't really want to watch Hateful Eight, you know, the theatrical cut, they're not going to want to watch a longer cut of it.
I also hate to put it this way, not to get too far off on a tangent. I guess it's Tarantino related, so it's not totally
too late.
But it's like Hateful Eight, like, none of his movies, he never does a ton of, like, trailers. Like, you kind of, every movie you sit down with is sort of a surprise. Like, you get a glimpse of what they're going to be, but you're not entirely sure. Like, Hateful Eight might be one of the ultimate examples of him being like, I'm making another Western. It's kind of like Django. There's race stuff in it. And then you sat down with it and you're like, Jesus, like, this movie's ugly and mean and
it's also
violent.
It's also a one location, like,
locker room
mystery.
Yeah.
You know, so.
It has more in common with a giallo than it does an actual spaghetti Western.
Well, he even said it was based kind of on The Thing as well, of just like.
Well, he uses the unused Ennio Morricone score for The Thing.
So which one was the one where the script leaked? Was that Inglourious or was that Django?
I don't remember.
Because that's where he got.
Well, when he got the temper tantrum.
But that was around Hateful Eight, wasn't it?
That was Hateful Eight.
So, like.
Where he basically.
One of the scripts had leaked, right? And he still made it, but he was pissed off. And then Hateful Eight, the script, like, leaked again. And he was like, well, I'm not doing it anymore. Go fuck yourselves.
Yeah. And it's like, and they did the live readings of it and stuff. And then he fell back in love with it.
Right.
And made the movie again. But it's just like, it's not even, we're like, Django's provocative, but, like, it still delivers a very crowd-pleasing entertainment.
It's more of an action movie, too, comparatively speaking.
Well, and it's like a superhero origin story in terms of, like, the cowboy at the center. But, like, and it has a movie star performance in terms of Jamie Foxx. Like, he didn't get Will Smith, but arguably he got a better choice because I could never see anybody but Jamie Foxx in that role now. But it's like, with Hateful Eight, you literally have, you know, Samuel L. Jackson delivering monologues about, like, skull fucking a man to death. And it's like, this movie's not fun to sit through.
Yeah, I mean, he beats the living shit out of a woman.
Out of Jennifer Jason Leigh. Yeah. All of the horror stuff in it when they're vomiting blood is just nasty and gross. Like, there's nothing, it's closest to, like, a Sam Peckinpah movie out of anything that he's ever made.
Yeah.
That could also account for it failing.
I mean, I think we're all right. It's super contained compared to
it
how
looks
epic.
Great, man.
Yeah. Like, I'm not saying it's not a good movie. I love the movie. Just, like, these are the reasons why it underperformed. Well, it was super contained. It didn't have a huge star in it. You know, it was a tough set for a mainstream audience.
Well, it's also back to our earlier, kind of talking about what people think when they think Tarantino. And I think for like the old heads who like really loved him since the beginning, we have a wider, it's not pretentious, but who fucking cares? Like a wider love for him in terms of like, we're like, where's all the crazy violence or where's the crazy like mowing down Hitler scene? Like,
yeah,
there are certain expectations that certain people have of the more action heavy stuff where it's like, if I get Tarantino dialogue and I get his worldview, like I want to watch it. Right.
Sure.
You know, like, so same with Grindhouse, right? I think it failed because people had an idea of what it was going to be, which it wasn't quite.
Stunts and, you know.
Oh, it's amazing.
Grindhouse is just, yeah, the death proof.
All the incredible. Driving stuff is insane.
Oh, yeah.
So, double feature. How does this work? We didn't think these questions through or adapt them for Kill Bill because it's 4.5 hours long. Technically was a double feature to begin with. It was two movies. Let's put it this way. What? How about a more creative question out of this is, what movie out of all the stuff that you discovered watching Kill Bill was your like biggest discovery out of that movie?
It was Battle Royale for me.
Well, shit. Yeah, that's a good one.
I mean, I just think even fucking in the Whole Bloody Affair, it's a tribute to that too.
To Kenji Fukasaku.
Yeah. So like for me, that was just like, and also like with some of these films, there is an expectation of, oh my God, it's going to be as crazy as Kill Bill. And a lot of them aren't.
Right.
You know, you have elements of it, but that was one where I'm like, no, this holds up to the insanity of Kill Bill.
I would go with a Diagram Pole Fighter just because of the Gordon Liu.
That's fucking great, dude.
Yeah.
Lady Snowblood.
Yeah. Also really great.
Yeah. I mean, I had already seen Kill Bill. I mean, Battle Royale, thankfully.
Yeah, I was late. I was late to the party on that.
But yeah, no, Lady Snowblood was. I mean, Corbucci just overall, you know, like finally getting into him as a filmmaker, just having a little bit more appreciation for giallo in general, like did deeper dives, you know, into that and spaghetti westerns. But Lady Snowblood is just like, this is phenomenal, and this is a phenomenal movie star actress. You know,
Twisted Nerve was another one with Haley Mills where they used the whistling theme song from it. So I think that this is a redundant question, but we're going to ask it anyway. Face Melter. Yay, nay.
Big old yay.
Yeah. Almost
the definition.
One of the greatest acts of face melting is Kill Bill, The Whole Bloody Affair. Like the fact that you're able to maintain that tone and that intensity for 4.5 hours is just absolutely ridiculous.
I mean, I'm going to paraphrase my friend Jimmy Hemphill. You know, we wrote for IndieWire when the Vista did their Whole Bloody Affair run this past summer or fall. You know, he said it, you know, could be the best movie ever made.
Right.
But it is certainly the most movie ever made. And I mean, that is such a great way to put what Kill Bill is. So it goes right back. Face Melter. Is it the biggest face melter? Yeah, it's definitely a face melter. Is it the biggest? No. But it might be the most of anything. Like, the highs in Kill Bill, I mean,
they're maybe, as high as anything.
Exactly, yeah. As high as anything can get in cinema. They're truly incredible. I mean, my moment that my brain really just breaks is when, like, it's the whole, like, the House of Blue Leaves, when they go out into the courtyard and they just start fighting, and that Santa Esmeralda song kicks in.
Yeah. The clapping. And
the snow is falling, and it's falling, like, super slow. And you could just hear, you know, like, the water in the background, you know. And, you know, Oren stands there, and her eyes look up at the bride and the horns kick in on that song, and you're just like, this is exactly what I want out of cinema.
Well, and Jake and I talk about this a lot too, where it's like, for me,
Midnight my favorite movie of all time, but while I'm watching certain movies, this is the best movie I've ever seen. Like, while I'm in it. And this is one of those movies where it's like another one is honestly like John Woo's Hard Boiled, where I'm in it and I'm just like, this is the best movie ever made. Yeah. Like, if you said I could only watch, or even a movie like The Abyss, I know it's a very different cut, but just a movie that I'm so immersed in, and I'm like, this is everything I want from cinema, as you said.
Yeah, and it's also like the definition of a secret handshake viewing now too, because like it was so hard to see for the longest time. It was a thing that people wanted for years and decades at this point. And then when you finally get it, like, it was selling out. We were watching it with these big sold out crowds of cinephiles who just wanted to experience, you know, this master cut of this movie. And it's an absolute joy to behold.
Yeah. And it was cool to be in an audience and like realize the pull this movie still has, that, you know, that everyone, it just, you know, it was great to be in Austin and just have like these hundreds of seat theaters just filled.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Well, guys, this has been great. Another big title kind of taken off the board for Secret Handshake. Martin, we've got one more before the end of the year.
Yeah.
We're going to do our top movies of 2025.
Yeah, it's going to be.
Get that up by New Year's Eve.
But you know, leading to the holiday here, we're going to go celebrate Jacob's birthday now.
Exactly. We're going to go get fucked up. So we'll see you guys on the other side of that.
All right.
If we don't get arrested. Bye.
Bye.
misunderstood. Share. That's one thing.